Hey everyone, it's Carmita. I wanted to let you guys know that this is part one of a two-part special episode. The episode is on Kelsey Emily Collins. In the interviews that I do, sometimes her family members refer to her as either Kelsey or Emily. Just know that they are talking about the same person. So with that, let's get into it. Hey everyone, it's Carmita. Welcome to Missing in the PNW. So today, guys, we're going to do everything pretty much completely different. We're just going to take a 180 approach on this case. So today we're going to be talking about Kelsey Emily Collins. She was a beautiful, vibrant 18-year-old who went missing on May 9th, 2009 from Everett. I think you guys have heard me speak about Everett before. Everett's about 3.5 hour drive north from Portland. And I believe it is north of Seattle too. It's all up in that area where you guys hear me talk about a lot, Seattle and the waterways, sex trafficking, Federal Way. I talked about that on Age's episode as well. So just keep in mind, we're kind of in that, but we're also going to be going down to Portland. So what we're doing, instead of me doing an episode where, you know, I talk about the case and then I do like an interview, I am actually going to let her family do everything. I'm really honored and really happy that they're here talking with me. And, you know, just a little trigger warning as well for everyone. We are going to be talking about some sensitive topics, you know, possible abuse, sex trafficking, sexual abuse, all of that. So I just forewarn you guys now. I know my mom likes to listen to these. Mom, don't listen to this when my little nieces and nephews are around, because it's going to be a lot. So let me shut up now, and I'm just going to go ahead. I'm going to let my guests introduce themselves, and we're just going to jump right on in.
Hi, I'm Sarah Collins. I am Kelsey's mom. And we've lived in the Pacific Northwest about 22 years.
Hi, I'm Dominique, Kelsey's oldest sister. And again, yep, just to reiterate what my mom said, we've been in the Pacific Northwest. I currently reside in the Seattle area, actually, which is about 2 hours from Portland, 2.5. And for about 22 years now.
And I did hear that actually in the other, you know, podcasts and some of the stuff. It's something I don't know if you guys can talk about, but you guys, just to make it clear, you're not from the Pacific Northwest.
No.
Okay. Okay. But you've lived here.
Yeah,
okay.
A couple decades.
Yeah. A long time. Okay. I'm thinking, yeah, like, that's more than half my life. So.
Yeah. All yeah. Right. We moved around a lot. You know, just briefly touch on some domestic violence issues that had occurred. And, you know, we just kind of traveled over into Washington State. One of the reasons being is that Washington State will seal name change records. And so that was, this is where we've ended up, just through, you know, our own domestic violence journey into safety.
You guys are so brave, and so I don't, oh, I can't even give you guys as many props as you guys deserve.
Oh,
so I just, yeah, because like I said, I know a little bit about how that is, but I think if you guys want to just start, you know, tell the listeners about how much you want to about her life, and we'll get into, you know, the case. And from what I think, honestly, this is just my opinion, why she's missing.
Okay, Mom, go ahead.
So Emily did have some learning disabilities. She had some hearing problems. And so she was really behind in school. And she kind of got really wild around the age of 11 or 12, just as she was, you know, kind of starting to enter puberty. And pretty much anybody who's raised teenage girls knows, you know, it can be a rough time. And she seemed to just, she was drawn to the wrong type of people. She was drawn to the wild side, and it was really hard to get her to understand how dangerous they were.
Was that in Everett, or was that in surrounding areas?
Kind of in the whole surrounding area. We moved to Everett when she was about 16. We lived in North Seattle for most of the first, I think about 8 years that we lived here. We were in the North Seattle area. And one of the places they used to love to go was the mall. And I always thought, oh, that's a nice, safe place, the mall. And it really is not a very safe place.
So that's something I want my listeners to actually know. I don't know if I've talked about it before, but I have talked about Portland and Seattle being big hubs for sex trafficking. And actually right over the bridge, I don't know if you guys have ever been to Vancouver Mall. Vancouver Mall had been known in the past for being a big sex trafficking hub.
Well, yeah, I've been there once or twice. Yeah, just like in passing, but I've been there a couple times, and I did not know that about that. Wow.
Yeah, I didn't know that about that particular mall either, but I do, you know, and I didn't know any of this when she was really going through it. I really just didn't think any of those things happened. I knew that older teenagers were using younger teenage girls to sell drugs or to hold drugs. I knew that that was going on. And that's actually was kind of my big fear at the time, was that she was getting involved in drug use. And her father was an alcoholic, so, you know, that just brings up the whole scary thing. You don't want them to become addicts or alcoholics. And the younger they start drinking and start using drugs, the easier it is for that to happen. But I really, you know, I didn't know that sex trafficking existed. And it took a long time for me to really believe what was going on with her.
Yeah, I remember a story, and I may have the details a little skewed, but like I remember specifically, Kelsey had said like she was thrown into a van and she had been raped, and I think it was all from either her missing curfew or her, and again, my details are really askew, but I guess what my mom is trying to say is that is the stories that follow along with these incidences and the grooming are so outlandish at times that you think that they're made up because they're so grandiose. And so I know myself, when I would hear these things, I would even say immediately, I'm like, she's just lying to get out of trouble. She's just lying to get out of trouble. And that was my take on things. And how wrong I am now plays a large part of the guilt and all of that, because there were signs.
But again, some of these signs were so big that it just didn't seem possible. It sounded made up. Emily fell into this crowd. And, you know, she had even told me at one point when I asked her, I think she was around 15 or 16, and she said she was a part of the Bloods, you know, the Bloods and Crips and all of that, war and turf and all of this other stuff. And again, I just was like, well, so you got jumped, you know, because she was beat up. I'm thinking, so you just got jumped into a gang? Like, that's the stories that she would specifically tell me. And so I had no clue that she was actually at the time being victimized and sex trafficked. I thought it was completely something different.
And yeah. I think we're going to get into this a little more, but one of the big things that I focus on all the time is the way that the media and especially the police portray young girls from marginalized communities. They automatically think they're a runaway. They automatically think that they're doing something bad. They automatically think that, like, oh no, it's cool, they'll come back. And actually,
they automatically think they're gang members. They automatically think that they're prostitutes.
Yeah,
that they're drug addicts. They never go and say these women are in trouble and in danger, and they actually do come from, you know, decent households, middle class households, whatever the case is.
Yeah.
It's a tragedy.
It is. Yeah. And I have some scary statistics too. So in a 2009 study, trafficking victims actually reported that being arrested an average of 7 times during their exploitation, and those encounters with the police were often cited as one of the most traumatizing experiences that survivors can endure.
Right.
And listening to a lot of stuff, you know, it sounds like, and I'm sure we'll get into, but it sounds like the cops kind of picked up Kelsey and it was just like, okay, bye. They didn't care about a lot of things. And it's...
Well, no, she was in juvenile, wasn't she, Mom?
Multiple times.
Yeah.
They would say, well, we picked her up for prostitution. And you're like, she's 15. You know?
That's
barring the fact that there's, you know, there's an age of consent. And
that's what
these girls are under it.
Mm-hmm. Not only that, but why are you looking at the girls? You should be looking at the people who are doing this to them.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, it still goes on today. You know, there's different areas, but you can drive down these main drags and you can see these girls. You know what they're doing. And people men just pull up in cars and nobody says a word to the men. The police are still at this point, and this has been, she's been gone 14 years. So they're still going after the kids. And I'm not sure. If I thought they were picking them up to put them into some kind of program to help them get better, to help them face the trauma they were in, it would be one thing. But they're not. They're just throwing them in juvie, and they end up with these long juvenile records and lost in the system. And that was actually one of the things when she did get picked up in Portland by Portland police, and I went down and got her. And a few weeks later, one of the detectives called me, and the first thing I said to him was, you know, the juvenile system has not really helped her at all. So I don't know why you're even talking to me. And he was like, no, no, no. I understand what you're saying. We're not trying to arrest her. Because I literally thought they were trying to set an appointment to come arrest my daughter. That was what I thought was going on when they first called me. And they're like, no, no, she's the victim. She's the victim here. And that was different than I heard from any of the police departments in the Seattle area. You know, it's a big sprawling city, and it has lots of little departments from, you know, Federal Way, Shoreline, Everett, Burien, Renton. You know, these are all what people would consider suburban Seattle. And they all have their little police departments.
Have you ever wondered what's at the root of homelessness?
I used to try to describe it to my husband that I said, I feel like I'm in this big spider web and I'm stuck in there.
And how wraparound approaches at missions aim to make a difference?
It's the things like that, the people who communicated that in spite of my rough edges, that they authentically cared about me.
On the Restorers podcast, we'll talk to experts, investigate current issues, share stories, and give you an inside look at how we at Water Street Mission tackle issues related to homelessness and poverty every single day. Join us by searching Restorers wherever you find your podcasts.
Being on that water too is a hub for trafficking. And you guys, honestly, up there, Seattle is not that far away from Canada.
That's right. True. Yeah. It's just a little over 2 hours to the Canadian border.
Well, I thought there was a statistic at one point that said between Oregon and Washington, we were ranked like it was number, weren't we number one or two in sex trafficking because of the I-5 corridor? Yeah.
Yeah, I talked about that on my podcast episodes. I can't remember which one it was, but I believe Seattle was number one. They were the sex trafficking hub. Right. And then just some other like really scary statistics. In any given time, 4.8 million people are victims of human sex trafficking around the world. Mm. And, you know, 71% of trafficking victims are women and girls. The average age that a girl ends up in human trafficking is 15. So,
right
around that age. It's scary to think about, especially, because like I said, I have my daughter will be 15 in June. So it's
right.
You never think, you know, what's going on.
So then what? So after you got the phone call, Mom, it wound up being really a different situation than what you had originally thought. Did you want to continue from there?
Yeah, so the detective came up to our house, and he brought his partner. There was two of them. One was a woman, one was a man. And they talked to Kelsey alone for a long time. And when she was done, she was visibly upset. And then they talked to me, and they kind of told me the backstory about what was really going on. And they were literally taking girls up and down I-5 between Portland and Seattle. That was one of their big hubs. So they would take Seattle girls down to Portland and throw them on the street and tell them that they had to bring in a certain amount of money a night. And I kid you not, it's been 14 years. And 14 years ago, they were basically told they had to bring in $1,500 a night. And that's just kind of mind-boggling that that much money is being changed hands, and they're not arresting the Johns, they're not arresting the pimps, they're arresting the girls. And but you know, they had said, no, we're trying to get, you know, this group of people, and they're really bad. They haven't just been doing this, you know, they've been doing drugs and weapons, but they saw this as one of the easier ways to make money, because it's easy to threaten the girls. It doesn't cost them very much. They go out and say, well, we'll get your nails done, or we'll buy you a new outfit. And before you know it, they're using that against them and saying, well, I did this for you, you've got to do this for me. And it was, as a parent, it was horrendously scary what was going on. And I know that by the time it came time for her to actually testify in the grand jury, she had gotten picked up again in Seattle for prostitution. And it was just like, it's hard to believe that they would treat her so differently between the states or the cities. And make no mistake, I mean, Portland, I'm sure, was ahead of their time.
There's a lot of history I can tell you guys about Portland just growing up there. That's not very good.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
gosh,
that department was, that at the time, was very small. And I don't know why they switched things up. I don't know what the precipitating thing was, but it was also a very small department. They had like 4 detectives that were trying to change an entire system about what happens to girls on the street. And, you know, even for a long time, you know, I thought the only time that girls were really on the street is because they had run away from home and they didn't want to follow the rules.
Well, and that's the perception that's out there. That's
yeah.
I was just going to say,
because that's
that.
The narrative. That's
yeah.
The narrative when you hear it in the news.
And it's,
you
ten
know,
times
at the time.
Worse for kids. It's 10 times worse for kids who are Black or Asian,
right,
or Hispanic or Native. And that's the first thing that anybody, oh, you're Hispanic, oh, you're Black, you're part of a gang, you out there doing this because you want to do. And that's, yeah, that's the perception. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. That's the narrative that's out there. You know, you don't hear about the school life. They don't interview the friends. You don't see any of this, you know, the structure in the life of these girls that go missing. You just hear about all the bad stuff they've done. And then the people at home are sitting there watching the news, shaking their heads, saying, yep, that sounds about right. Well, no, that's not right at all. There is a backstory. There are circumstances that have happened. And, you know, the bottom line is that these are still children. They're children. This is somebody with a child's mind who is not fully developed, who cannot differentiate, you know, between right and wrong all of the time. All of that, and none of it gets taken into consideration, especially with marginalized women and children, you know. And I don't know why. I don't know why we're looked at so differently. I don't know why Emily wasn't looked at just as important as, you know, Becky down the street,
yeah,
you know? So,
yeah. And that's the thing I always talk about, because I honestly don't believe that the system is broken. I believe that the system was designed for people of marginalized communities to fail.
Yeah. Yeah. In a lot of respects. Absolutely.
And it's sad too, because a lot of trafficking victims are prosecuted for these crimes that they're forced to commit.
Yeah.
So how does that make sense?
Right. Right. All of the bruises, all of the cut hands, none of that is looked at. And I don't mean fresh bruises. I mean the ones that are healing from weeks before. The broken arms, you know, the fractured, yeah, the fractured wrists. All of that, the cut fingers, you know, all of these healing wounds. You would think to an average person or police officer or detective or anybody else in law enforcement or agencies, and you would think and you would sit back and say, there's something else going on here. This is not what's really happening. This is not the perception that this is the perception that they want us to see. But this girl is an actual danger. That's what's happening. She is not out here at 1, 2, and 3 in the morning of her own volition because she wants to be selling herself. That's not the case. And again, I can continue to emphasize, all of it is out the door. None of that is looked at. All of it is, what are you doing out here at 3 o'clock in the morning? Or you must be up to something bad. You have no business out here. So let's go ahead and drag you in and see what's going on. Oh, you're out here making money. Oh, you have drugs, you know, whatever. And the next thing you know is, boom, you're facing a charge at 16. At 16, your parents are called. You know where we found your daughter? On Aurora or wherever the place is. What are you doing to deal with this at home? That's the narrative that you get. You know what I mean? That's the conversation that you walk into. And then it just perpetuates down the line. And then the child gets home and the parent says, well, what exactly were you doing out at 3 o'clock in the morning? Looking like this, doing whatever, having this much amount of money on you. What? And again, there's no compassion in the beginning. So because that is lacking, the parent is now angry. The parent has no understanding. And all you did was perpetuate the cycle. And guess what? The next weekend, that child is out on the street again because she has no choice. Because nobody bothered to sit her down and say, what's happening? What are you going through? Who had you out here? Tell us what's going on.
Exactly.
Those questions are never asked.
Yeah.
And that's what's upsetting.
Yeah. I mean,
this all could have been handled differently.
Yep.
For years, this could have been handled differently.
Yep.
Sorry. No, I don't mean to get on. I'll get to preaching here in a minute and it'll be just. You girl,
this is
I get upset. I get so upset behind all
this
of it.
No, it's good because this is the type of difficult conversations that people need to have. People need to stop acting like there isn't racism, there isn't prejudice, there isn't like there is white privilege. There's not. People need to stop acting like this stuff doesn't happen and, right. Oh, it could happen to anybody. No, it happens to marginalized communities.
Right.
And right. That's what a lot of people don't. I'm going to sit there and have the difficult conversations. You're going to listen whether you like it or not.
Right.
And, you right. know, and I, there's this other statistic that I found, which I can't for the life of me understand. You know, there are adults who that's their chosen, you know, they're sex workers. Okay, that's fine. I'm not going to judge you how you make your money. But right. the government is so dumb and the police are not trained and they don't know how to tell the difference. So in 2018, the government got $24 million to try to help with trafficking prevention. 90% of that money went to arresting consensual adult sex workers. 90% wow. of that money.
So, and that, this is from Oregon, this is from Portland that you're talking about, or is this nationwide?
That's nationwide.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And it's like, you're wasting all this money on, you know, people who, I don't know, do porn or whatever, but you're not paying attention to the little girls who, right. Like, what are you, why in your head do you?
Well, you're not paying attention to, you're not paying attention to the victims,
exactly.
The children, the minors that this money is allocated for, correct?
Why do you automatically look at that little girl and think that she's doing it because she wants to do it?
Right. I did not know that. I did not know that statistic. That's incredible.
And I mean, let's not even go into COVID and how much that has made everything worse.
Yeah, I believe that that was a system breakdown for sure.
Oh yeah.
In multiple different ways. And I think in the last 12 months, as a nation or even as a state, especially Seattle as a city and a community, I mean, that mental health crisis alone took a nosedive during COVID. And there's almost no hope of coming out of that.
That's another thing.
That's a totally different subject, because this, then we could definitely get into the homelessness, the economy, the, you know, all of that, you know, especially, but I can only imagine the effects that, you know, that it perpetrated with, you know, in-house abuse, you know, molestation, prostitution, sex trafficking, because who was looking?
Exactly.
Who was out here looking? Nobody. Everybody was at home.
Yeah.
Mandatory, you know, but all of those abuses were still happening.
Yeah.
And
the
damage that was done is probably astronomical at this point. And we're just talking 3 years later. Well, we're still in it, kind of. Nobody knows what's happening.
Nobody does ever know what happened.
Nobody knows what's happening.
Things change literally daily with everything. Everything changes. And
So with Emily, I didn't want to get us too off subject, but so with Emily, mom, once you heard the story, or once you heard what was going on in the circumstances, what were your next step as a parent? And, you know, because I can't speak for this, Carmita, because I wasn't involved in this portion of it. So I'm really unaware of what happened at the moment in time. I know now, but go ahead, mom.
Yeah. So, you know, I had long conversations with the detectives, and they were, trying to tie up loose ends. And they called me probably 15 months after she got picked up in Portland. I mean, this was, there were ongoing conversations, but about 15 months later, they had said that they had finally got the prosecutor to get a grand jury together, and they needed her to testify. And I was like, well, she's back in juvie for the same things. And they were like, that's actually perfect, because we don't want to tell her she's got a subpoena because we're afraid she'll run away. And, you know, they told me that they had joined two different cases. They had found the people were the same people, and they had found two different girls. And I didn't really know what was going on with the other girl for a long time, other than I knew she was a couple years younger. And, so we went to court, and I knew that they were coming down with this federal subpoena. And her lawyer kept asking me what was going on. I was like, I don't think I really want to tell you. And she goes, well, I'm her lawyer, not your lawyer. And I'm going to find out eventually. And that's when I said, well, there's a detective from Portland that's coming down with a federal subpoena to serve her, to testify in front of a grand jury. And then everything got, you know, like, they got a hold of the judge, they got a hold of the prosecuting attorneys, they had these big, big powwows behind closed doors. And they basically said that they had put the case on hold for her case, from, you know, her prostitution charge, and that when they showed up with the subpoena, they would take her into custody from there. And if she cooperated with them, basically they were going to drop the charges. And, you know, she sat down with me and she basically said she was scared. And I looked at her, and to this day, this is still got a guilt threshold on me. I said, do you want other girls to go through what you're going through? And she said, no. And I said, the only way that's going to change is if you testify. And she said, okay. And, you know, I think back about how brave that was for her to do that.
But that's not on you, Sarah. That's, you don't have to feel guilty, because honestly, I think it was the cops in the first place that put them in their head. Because how are you going to go to a little girl and say, oh, you're either going to testify or we're going to charge you with this and you're going to end up in jail? Like, how right. is that a way to approach something?
Right. Right. Yeah, you're putting it on the victim now. Like, what is that?
Exactly.
And she was brave for doing that. She was. You know, that really talks about her personality, because outside of all of this, Kelsey was kind. You know, she was sweet. She was very thoughtful. You know, was she a rebellious teenager? Yeah, of course. Who wasn't? Like, I mean, that
just happens.
Yeah,
find me one that isn't.
That's right. That doesn't go, that doesn't show somebody's entire character. You know, if anyone was in need, Kelsey was always a helping hand. Yeah, she was a helping hand. She had no problem. She offered all the time. You know, she
would babysit for all the people in the area, you know, like in our apartment complex. She was always babying. She loved babies.
Right. You know, she was a nice person. And to put that decision-making on her, with, you know, veiled and or direct threats, you know, again, all you're doing is abusing a victim who's been abused. That's abuse. And, you know, even if they said something to my mom, and I'm not sure if they did, or had a threatening tone with her, again, you're talking about a domestic violence survivor. That, again, veiled or direct threat, that's abuse of power. And you're victimizing an already victim and, you know, survivor in and of itself. And so, you know, dealing with the police in this situation, especially for my mom, was upsetting. It was tough. There were a lot of times we didn't have answers. There were a lot of times we couldn't get answers. You know, there were a lot of times we were treated as not accuser,
poor
but we
parental.
Were treated. What's the word?
Poor parental decisions.
Yeah, like
you know,
there was.
If
just...
I had done something different, this wouldn't have happened. Right. It's kind of like, well, number one, they're teenagers. This is part of the growing up process. But again, like, you know, my daughter mentioned, we'd already gotten out of a situation with our lives. And that in itself was just a horrible, horrible experience. And even the help that they try to offer you, you always, I remember when we left the transitional housing, I wrote a long letter and I'm like, you talk about how you want women to be empowered and to stand up for themselves. But you're just as controlling as the abusers they left. You have right. So many rules in your system that you can't break or you're going to get thrown out. And, it's everything is triggering, Everything with dealing with the police at that point in my life was a trigger to something that had gone wrong earlier in my life. Not thinking people believed you. Having people think you were crazy. Not understanding why do you just not leave? And they could say that to these teenage girls. Why don't you just leave? Because I get handcuffed to a bed, because I get beat up by people who show up at the place I live, which did happen. One day a couple guys came in and they went down to the pool house in our condo, and she came back beat up, and they were long gone, and she was terrified for me to call the police.
That's why, like you said, Kelsey was really, really brave, but it's stuff like this where this is why people don't want to say anything. This is why people, suppress everything, because if they do, people feel like, what really does it change?
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's certainly the mind thought of victims. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then I mean, there's so much stuff in the past, 15 years too, that has changed with social media, with all of, mental health is bad. Yeah. But like all of the new terms like gaslighting and people actually realizing that they've been through a lot of bad stuff and they just didn't know what it was until now.
Until they've left, until you've gotten the help. Yeah. If the help is available. Right. Right.
Yeah. And it's a lot to deal with for anybody, but yeah, when you're a kid,
but you're also, I didn't mean to cut you off, Carmina, you're also talking about, young women, who are, pinpointed and specifically picked out. And
yeah,
what I mean
profiled.
By that is, profiled. And what I mean by that is that you're talking about girls with disabilities, girls who live in a certain community, kind of all of a certain color, of a certain naivete, and they are, like you said, they're profiled, they're watched. And then they are just completely torn down from the inside out and made to believe a lot of the times that this is as good as it gets. This is what's happening. This is where I'm supposed to be because I don't deserve this, or I don't know any better, or, and especially with somebody like with a low IQ, Emily, Kelsey specifically had, Mom, she had a hearing disability as well as a learning disability, it was like a double whammy. And so, of course, she falls, unfortunately, into a category where she is susceptible to being victimized.
Yeah. You know, and that's what they go after. And they know. They know. They're watching. They are profiling. They're sitting at schools. They're sitting at malls. They're watching. You know, they're following them home.
Yeah.
I remember a few instances where Kelsey says she was followed. And she would come, you know, she had come running into the house. And, you know, it's just, it's, and you brush it off, you think it's nothing, but in reality, that's the beginning. That's the start of all of it. And, you know, she fell into it. And I don't think she knew at all, how to reach out for help, how to ask for help, how to even think that possibly she even deserved better, you know?
Yeah.
That she could ask for better, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just, you know, like you said too, they go out because they don't know any better. And then, I mean, obviously not in this case, but there are cases that it's sometimes it's better to be out than be at home.
Right.
And then that's how stuff happens cases. Too.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Yeah, of course. Yeah. If you're being molested and sexually abused at home, you don't want to go back there. And if something better comes up, even though it's not better, but do you know what I mean? But you fall into that, what was that, Stockholm?
Yeah, because you know? They make you believe that it's better.
Right. And now you have no safety net. You have no outlet. You have no resources available. You don't have friends. You don't have families. You've been alienated. You wouldn't go back to your family if you could, because that's the situation you just came out. So it's all of that. There are so many of these girls out here that are from so many different backgrounds,
yeah,
and circumstances and traumas. And it's just, people suck. I mean,
they do.
We're the worst.
The system sucks.
We're the worst.
And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know. So going back, you know, the police should have given Kelsey some type of anything, some type of, you know, safety net, some type
resources,
of
resources. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything.
And I don't know how to go about this, because I don't want to play favorites, or I don't want it to sound bad, but the other girl that was in that case, I mean, was she from a marginalized community? Was, I mean, because I heard that they gave her help. They
did give her help. I know nothing about her other than her initials.
Okay.
And that she was a couple years younger. They never told me more about it. And a lot of that was because she was a minor. You know,
right.
They were trying not to break any rules in that respect. I knew her initials, and I knew that she was a couple years younger than Emily. But that was all I knew about her. And I do know that they had put her in someplace in California. They had moved her to California, and in a home that was specifically to treat victims of sexual abuse.
There's so many questions.
never gotten an answer as to why didn't you protect my daughter?
Yeah.
I understand the anonymity part, and I understand, you know, yeah, that is a minor. And I mean, technically, if they want to go about it, you know, Kelsey was 18 or she was turning 18. And if that person was younger, then yeah, more vulnerable. But at the same time, you question, yeah, just like you said, like, why? Like, what was it that gave that girl,
right.
You know, did she not have no family though? Or it could go either
and we
way.
Don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah, and there's so many questions. And a lot of it is that, you know, my mom's has always said, well, when you started this case with Kelsey, she was a minor. She was 15, 16 years old. So treating her as, you know, she's 18 and she's out of your hands, she's out of the system, and throwing her away is absurd because she was a minor when you needed her.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's always, that is always stuck with us, is we're not understanding the correlation between A and B right now, because when A happened, she was a minor. B is happening now, and you're saying there's nothing you can do because she's an adult. But did you ask her? Did you ask us? Did you talk to anybody else? Or did you just make this decision? Is this just a policy and a rule? Because if it is, you should disclose that from the beginning.
Something needs to change.
And that conversation should look a lot like, we understand you're a minor now, we need your help now, but remember, when you turn 18, you're out of our hands. You know, that would go a long way to what you are asking these girls to risk, which is their lives.
Yeah.
And if you're not being fully disclosed on the system, then what are we doing? We're victimizing them for a third time, which is essentially what you did to my sister. You victimized her again. It's upsetting.
I get it, because
I get angry. I get very angry.
Yeah. And, but again, I think that's something that people need to hear, because if you haven't gone through something, you don't really know when it comes to, you know, going all back to prejudice, racism, all of that. I'm half Mexican and half Native, and I've been prejudiced against, you know, and it's stuff that people don't want to believe that happened. And, but at the same time, like, you know, there are questions like, okay, well, you know,
I believe it was the first question I asked. I asked if the other girl was white. I did.
Yeah, exactly.
I asked. I was like, is she white? Was she white? Because I don't understand. None of this is making any sense to me.
Yeah.
She had to have been a little white girl. Because I don't understand why everybody had a helping hand.
Yep.
Everyone had this helping hand.
Yep.
Except for my sister. What happened with that? You just dismissed the case?
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean? Like, all of that. So, yes, my first question and my first thought was immediately, she has to have been white. She has to have been. Whether she is or she isn't is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
That's the stigmatism that you've now put on.
Exactly.
Women of color, people of color, is that you are more willing to help the Beckys and the Susans and the Hillarys of the world, who were white with blue eyes and blonde hair or brown hair, whatever you want to call it, but they are Caucasian, far more than you are willing to help any Native Americans, Mexican Americans, Black, you know, Asians, Pacific Islanders, all of it, LGBTQ. I mean, my God, that community has been victimized over and over and over.
Yep.
And
God forbid someone is, you know, all of those things.
And so again, like I said, you know, that was honestly my first question. I thought this girl was, and again, I don't know.
I have no idea.
But that's where that as a woman of color, that's where my mind goes. It usually does most of the time, because it's usually true. It's usually true.
Yep.
And that's disheartening, and it's defeating, and it's angering. And then you're angry, and then you have no answers, and then you have no outlet. And all you know is that someone you love and someone you grew up with is out there somewhere, either going through this day to day to day, this abuse, this horrific situation, or they were murdered and you don't know where they are. And then you're just like, where are you? Where are you? Where are you? And that is all you think about. And I commend my mother, because I could not even imagine. This is just my sister.
Yeah.
This is my child. You know, my heart breaks for all of the mothers and the fathers out there that have that have had this situation or something similar happen where they've lost a child to circumstances that could have been helped. And that's the key.
Yeah.
Circumstances that could have been helped and certainly had a different outcome had the resources have been there, had the concern and the compassion had been there in the first place, all of that. And it's a lot to talk about. It's a lot to go through. And you know, we sit here day in and day out, you know, regardless of whoever made the mistakes, just out. We're just out. We're just, there's nothing. It's all in the wind. There's nothing. There's no answers. There's no, what's the word I'm looking for? Closure.
Yeah.
There's no closure. You know, and
a lot of times that's worse than knowing.
Yeah. It's very, yeah. I think if we knew, you can mourn, you can grieve, you can go through all of those. Well, there's all we go through is hope being dashed, and that's a roller coaster you certainly don't want to be on. You know, it's sad. All of it is just, I don't know.
So that was part one, guys. You are going to have to wait until next week for part two. Until then, have fun, but be safe.